Well, that puts a bit of a burden on my shoulders there. Well, I'll tell you one interesting thing about dense suspensions. So the one interesting thing about dense suspensions, of many that I will talk about, is shear thickening. So, phenomena, paradox, resolution, consequences. So I'll try and cover things in that order. I won't try and attribute the stuff I'm describing to individual people. Many are here on this program. What I'm going to describe is a way of thinking about certain phenomena that has emerged, I would say, in the past 3 or 4 years via contributions from many people across quite a wide community, explaining what we think is going on in systems that show shear thickening. So let's start with phenomena. So we're talking about a system of dense, so-called hard sphere, and the quotes will matter eventually, suspensions. So we're talking about hard particles, roughly 1 micron in size, maybe a bit bigger. There's an oft-used parameter phi, which in these cases is bigger than about 0.5. This is the total fraction of space that is occupied by the particles. It's called the volume fraction. And we're interested, at least initially, in shear flow. So we have our sample here. It's undergoing that kind of shear. It's got these hard spherical particles in it. The surrounding material is a Newtonian solvent, such as water. I'll need some axes, x, y, z into the board. So this flow corresponds to a velocity along the x direction whose magnitude is proportional to the y coordinate, and the coefficient is called gamma dot. That's called the rate of strain. And we're typically interested in understanding the behavior of the shear stress, sigma xy. And in this talk, unless otherwise indicated, that's just going to be called sigma. So what do we see? Steady state experiment. So we try to impose a uniform state of shear flow onto the material, and we look at what the shear stress is doing as a function of the rate of strain. And we look at this for various values of the volume fraction. In any particular system, the volume fraction is fixed, but I consider a series of materials at higher and higher density of hard particles per unit volume. So I start off with something extremely boring. As I increase the volume fraction, I start to see something with a bit more structure in it. And then something else happens, which is behavior like that, with some kind of hysteresis. And if I choose the stress in here, so I can either control the stress or the rate of strain, so let's take a stress in that window there, then I see at fixed sigma some steady flow. So gamma dot as a function of t in this regime would be something like this. This would be for phi bigger than the critical volume fraction at which this starts to happen. And if I go further, so this is phi greater than some phi c, and if I go much greater, I even see stuff like this. So an intermittency where part of the time the system is not flowing at all. And the thing which is poorly described on this diagram here is that the magnitude of this jump here is of order 10 to the 3. So I should really have used a log plot to show you this. So these phenomena are visible in your kitchen. I brought along a bit of our kitchen from the elegant AITP residence today. Search a powder, just any supermarket. So if you stir this slowly, you do not feel much resistance. If you try to stir it faster and faster, you begin to feel quite a lot of resistance. Don't worry, it's only chalk, you're used to it. And it's pretty fluid until you try to pour it out. And then it starts doing stuff like this. You can see flow instabilities here, striations, wiggles, and it may stop altogether or it may not. It's just about to break in part now. So those are the phenomena. And yeah. So we guys are used to thinking about this stuff. So why is there an issue? Well, there's a kind of a theory, so a type of theoretical structure sitting in waiting to explain all this behavior. So the idea would be this is all broadly explicable. If, and this is a big if. So the big if is that underneath this we have the idea that there's some underlying constitutive behavior you'll find I break the chalk constantly. In other words, a putative set of functions, stress as a function of strain rate in steady state, which, and you will have guessed them already, look like this. So this is increasing phi. So here I have something boringly increasing, here it starts to lift off, here it goes not single-valued, and that's where hysteresis and flow instabilities can come from, and eventually you can, if you want this behavior, this curve has to come right the way back to the up axis and then shoot up the vertical axis. So these regions are unstable. Which is what we're seeing in these unsteady flows. And the hysteresis around here is very similar to what you expect in a thermodynamic system. It's basically a dynamical first-order phase transition. So in one sense, we can stop the talk there because everything's understood in terms of having this kind of underlying constitutive behavior for the stress as a function of the rate of strain. But this is where the paradox comes in. Paradox. So the paradox is that there's a standard model. Always a bad thing. So there's a standard model for suspensions. And you can see why, because by the time I talk about little granules of cornstarch powder in water, they've got electric charges on them, all kinds of things, you have to simplify. And the standard model is, as I hinted before, hard spherical particles in a Newtonian solvent such as water. And for particle sizes are bigger than about 1 micron, the following set of assumptions look pretty safe. Firstly is neglecting inertia. So the particle motion is overdamped at the particle scale. And you can work out a Reynolds number for typical flows, and it's 10 to the minus 5 or 6 or worse than that. So this seems good. Non-Brownian. So for particles which are much smaller than a micron, Brownian motion is crucial. The fact that they're whizzing around under thermal bombardment from the solvent is very important. But once they get very big, that motion becomes extremely slow. And in the suspension regime rather than the colloidal regime, we're used to neglecting it. Hard spheres. Say more about that in a second. And the other thing which we're used to assuming is that at the surface of these hard spheres, where they meet the solvent, there's a no-slip fluid boundary condition sphere solvent interface. So when I say hard spheres, what I mean is this. If I look at the direct interaction potential between two spheres, here's a force, here's a separation. This is twice the radius, and the idea is that there's no force at all, but you can't overlap. So the force as a function of separation is flat, 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 blows up to infinity. This is two particles separated by R. Plus hydrodynamic forces. So this is the force of interaction, if you like, the equilibrium force that two particles static would feel between each other. But because you're involved, you're stuck inside a solvent and you have a no-slip boundary condition, then there's also a velocity-dependent force which depends on your rate of approach. So these will be important, but the definition of hard is that. So the paradox about this standard model here is that it has, so standard model, no time scale. And equivalently, no force or stress scale. So it's a very scale-free theory. So there's no scale of force here because the force is either zero or infinity. There's no time scale because without Brownian motion or inertia, everything's overdamped. There isn't a time that I can construct from my parameters. So the result of that, I should start right over here, is that the standard model has something we call rate-independent rheology. Oops, independent. So rheology means flow behavior, for those on the other program, not to be confused with theology, often misprinted as such in abstracting services and so on. So shear stress is, this is the solvent viscosity, which I didn't name here, in a solvent, okay. So this scales with the solvent viscosity, it scales with the rate of strain, and there's some function, Sxy, which depends only on phi. So this is Newtonian scaling, if you like. Newtonian fluid, Newtonian, can't spell Newton, that's bad. And this is a steady state structure. I mean, this depends only on the structure, and this is gamma dot independent. So we do have a proportionality to the rate of strain, but basically what you have is you've got a Newtonian solvent which is moving in a very complicated geometry. Yeah?
Just a quick question. I had a question about your demonstration.
Yeah.
If our cornstarch was dry, is it yours mixed with water?
Yes. That's why it looks like a liquid.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I didn't bring the packet.
The concentration
It's above 50% solid. Okay, so the same applies to other stress components, and this is not Newtonian. So I can look at all elements of the stress tensor, and these ones which involve, these are normal stresses because they have the same index in these two places. These go like eta naught, and now I have a mod sign here, and then SXX, again, function of phi, etc. So this mod sign should alert your suspicions, so things are not analytic. Nonetheless, this is called quasi-Newtonian. In a Newtonian fluid such as water, all of these would vanish, and you'd just have the shear stress. And there's one twist here. S of phi might be infinity. So that corresponds to the case where the system is totally jammed up and you can't have a steady state flow in that case. So equals solid. But there's nothing in between. The standard model allows you to be solid if you're totally jammed, or it allows you your shear stress to be linear in the rate of strain if you're not totally jammed. It does not allow anything like these curves here. Any more questions while I start erasing the board? Okay. So, labouring the point slightly, stress, rate of strain, I have a set of curves which are not curves because each one of them is straight. The slope here is a to naught s of phi. Phi is increasing, and at some critical phi, I may get s infinite, or phi j, let's call that. So what we can do is we can look at s as a function of phi. So firstly, these lines are all straight. Nothing like that, nothing like that, no wiggles. No wiggle theorem of the standard model. Right. If I look at s of phi, I've said it might blow up as a function of phi. So this kicks off at 1 for very small phi because I just have water, and it looks something like this. Blow up point, phi sub j. So over here I have rate independent rheology, or rate independent flow. I can get my writing to work today. And over here I have a solid. Right, so we have to escape from this. Obviously something is missing. Standard model has served us well, but needs changing. Yes, sorry.
So you mentioned there were new things in the last few years. How long has this been known, this panel you're about to erase?
The phenomenology?
Yes.
15...
Sort
of mid to late 90s that this stuff started to really become clear, and then it has become much clearer in the last 5 years. Yeah. So obviously that has been known, since time immemorial. Yeah. So these kind of experiments, there's some signs of that in the older literature, but they've only really been closely looked at, I would say, in the last 10 years. Okay. So, escape from rate independence. So, what I'm going to present now is a sort of consensus view, which, as I say, has emerged from various parts of the community in the last few years. First element, there's going to be three parts in this escape route. We're going to have to plan it carefully. The first is that particles make contact. So that sounds innocuous, but it's not true in the standard model. Because in the standard model, if I have spheres, and I have a no-slip boundary condition, I have Stokes' equation, because everything's overdamped, and the time it takes for two particles of fixed force to come into contact is infinite. I have a lubrication film of Newtonian fluid, which takes an infinite amount of time to get out of the way. So this idea that particles make contact sounds very simple, but it was kind of not allowed in a large part of the early development of the subject, and that kind of held things up rather. So just to make a point of that, Stokes, not true. Oops, told you. With no slip. For spheres. Pointy particles, different. But it is true in practice. And this has been known for a while. So there's a proof experimental, of course. So this goes back to Akrovos, and someone called Galada. So this is actually 1980. So they did something quite clever, which is to do what we call flow reversal nowadays. So shearing this way, then you stop the flow. You can stop it for as long as you like, actually, because nothing happens when there's no flow going on. That's this whole rate independent story. No Brownian motion, nothing. And then just send it flowing in the other direction. So what I can do is I can look at the... I won't hurt my back anymore by putting it down there. I can look at the stress as a function of time during that experiment, or a function of the imposed strain. So there's a steady state value. So let's look at this. So when I reverse this, I expect the shear stress to reverse in sine. So let's look at the modulus of it and plot that, as a function of gamma dot t. And let's suppose the reversal is here. So this is 1 before the reversal, because I'm in the steady state, then what do you see is something like this. You suddenly do the reversal and you see a discontinuity. Let's call that delta. And then because I've taken the mod sign, this ends up back at 1 again eventually, but everything flowing the other way. So this discontinuity delta is order 0.1 for volume fractions which are well below the dense suspension regime, so 0.3. It's about 0.6 at phi equals 55% volume. So this is the kind of range that we're interested in. And they understood this to mean that at 55% in the steady state, 60% of your stress is being carried by direct interparticle contacts, and only 40% by lubrication films. How do they know that? Well, I've kind of implied already that the standard model has delta equals naught. And the reason is, again, to do with what we call Stokesian reversibility. If I reverse all the velocities of my hard spheres at fixed coordinates, so this flips the sign of sigma xy at fixed magnitude according to Stokes. In other words, if I believe that everything's hydrodynamic. So let's put an if here. So it's easy to understand that. If I have hard particles which never touch, so the only forces present are to do with the fluid in between. So suppose these are approaching at a speed V, and then there's a repulsive force F. And if this is Stokes flow, and I have no slip boundary conditions on these particles, then if I start, well, reverse the flow, I also reverse the forces. In other words, particles separated by a hydrodynamic lubrication film are exactly as difficult to pull apart as they are to push together. So if everything is hydrodynamic, what happens here on reversal is I suddenly stop pushing and start pulling on every contact that was previously being pushed, and vice versa. And so I should get an immediate flip of 100% of the stress. Then it should start to decay as the structure starts to reorganize, and then it should come back up again. But this continuity here is telling you that there is a large part of the stress which is not hydrodynamic in origin. So these are for hydrodynamic lubrication layers. Okay, so we have contacts. So that's the first thing that needs to be changed in the standard model.
Sorry, Mike.
Yes.
It's obvious that what has to be changed is contacts or deformability of particles.
Well, I was going to come back and say, look, these words are of negotiable meaning. What this actually means is that these particles have to feel a force directly between the particles, which I'm calling a contact force, but if they have some long-range interaction, that would do fine. And if they're squishy in shape, but there has to be a direct force which would be maintained in place if all the velocities were zero.
Right.
And there is no such force in the Stokesian picture. Okay, so if we decide that there are contacts, then we can introduce the second thing we need, which is to realize that contacts between hard particles have solid friction. So Wilson Poon talked a lot about this in an earlier one of these lectures. And this controls where the jamming point is. So this is a crucial point. We've got particles, they come into contact, the interactions between them can have frictional parts there, and the claim is that that is a determinant in where exactly this vertical asymptote lies. So I've got S of phi. This is my enhancement factor. Here's phi. I'm going to draw two asymptotes here, rather exaggerated scale. 58% solid, 64% solid. If I have a friction coefficient mu, which is much greater than 1, this curve diverges at around 58%, so things are jammed above about 58%. If there's no friction, so mu equals 0, mu being the static contact friction, then I've got about a 6 or 7% range of volume fraction to play with here. Now, 6 or 7% in volume fraction may not sound enormous. If you're an industrialist or someone selling food and you want, or making paint, for instance, the difference between having mid-50s and mid-60s volume fraction is extremely important, firstly because of the rheology and so on, but also you may want the solvent to dry out without the thing cracking, and et cetera, et cetera. So for formulation, that is a very big gap, and a lot of formulation science goes on in the bit around here. Okay, so what's the reason for that? So I'm going to attribute this to Edwards. Using arguments closely related to those of Maxwell, who was interested in how many struts you need to stop a bridge collapsing. So the idea is that if I have a frictional contact, it's the particles can roll on each other. If it's lubricated or non-frictional, so let's just say lubricated, they can roll, well, they can slide. Let's say that they can slide. So this is two constraints on their velocities, and this is only one. So if I have some packing of particles, it's tremendously important whether the contacts are frictional or lubricated, because the number of constraints set by those contacts is fundamentally different. If I look at a coordination number Z, so this is a property of any packing of particles in contact, the number of particles each one is touching, and I have a fraction F of the frictional one, so the fraction F of rolling, then if you do a simple task of counting the constraints and seeing whether your system is free to move or not, then here's Z, 6, 4, 0, 1, F. So between all sliding contacts, I need to have 6 per particle before the system is macroscopically jammed. If they're all rolling, I need only 4. So this is flowable, and that is jammed, and that is obviously linked to the concept over there of a rheologically fluid material and a solid. Okay, so things are beginning to fall into place, but this, what I've told you thus far, is still not quite enough. So I'm going to erase this, but this is highly pertinent to what I'm just about to say. Let's just erase the bottom half in that case. So there's a but. Mu, coefficient of static friction, is dimensionless. So in and of itself, it does not introduce a time scale or a stress scale, so I still have no wiggles. I still have rate-independent rheology for any fixed value of mu. So what I'm saying is that as a function of the density, I may have a different proportion of frictional, of rolling and sliding contacts, But at any density, that cannot depend on the rate at which I'm flowing, because there's no time scale, no stress scale, so there's no characteristic axis or point I can put on here or here that will change the situation from this linear curve here. So all of these curves will be shifted by friction, the slopes will all be different, but they'll all still be straight lines as a function of gamma dot. Okay, so that brings us to our third correction, and final, happily. And this came up a little bit in what Sriram said. And you might think, well, you know, by the time you've got rid of this one, what's left of your so-called standard model? But anyway, I'll write it down. Hard spheres are never really hard. So the reason that the hard sphere assumption came in, because people have known, colloid scientists have known for a long time, that you've got particle order of micron, and then at some sort of nanometer scale, typically, there is some sort of finite range to the interaction force. But that's a huge separation, so it's very easy to say, well, let's just replace that with nothing and then straight line vertical. But we have to do a little better than that to understand the wiggles on the shear thickening curves. So this is now my plot of the particle interparticle force, the static force as a function of R. This is the contact. This is what I drew before. And what we're going to say now is, okay, there's a little bit of something here. So this could be only a few nanometers. The more important thing here, though, is there's now a force scale. So this is the static force you need to do to push the particles to the point where the fluid is excluded against what will typically be some kind of screened Coulomb interaction, or you have colloidal particles generally stabilized with polymeric coatings or something with fluffy hair on the outside, so a bit of soft, gooey interaction before the particles really come into hard contact and all the fluid has gone away and you have these frictional effects. So a few nanometers, there may be much more, but that's enough. So, if I look in a shear flow, I can ask how big the interparticle force typically is. So, we can get that by dimensional analysis. It's F goes like some stress scale R squared. So the idea then is if F is less than F star, I have a finite gap, and mu effectively equals zero. In other words, my lubrication films are intact. But if F is bigger than F star, I have solid contact, and the effective mu is the real one for those kind of contacts. So then, as I see here, I've got this stress scale, and at very low stresses, I expect particles to be lubricated, but at high stresses, I now expect them to be in solid contact. So that's the key element to that. So what we can think about is the fraction F, so a fraction of rolling contacts, as a function now of stress. And now I do have a stress scale, as I've said. That's of order F star over R squared. There may be some weak phi dependence in that, but that doesn't matter so much. And what I've said is, okay, zero here, one here. And I have some kind of smooth behavior is the idea. So this is smooth. It's not immediately clear how a smooth thing is going to give you a first-order phase transition. But what I'm going to show next is a smooth behavior of F combined with the fact that the jamming point varies, so phi j varies depending on the state of friction, will actually give us the flow curves that I was sketching earlier. Okay, so here's the resolution, and I'm going to use all of the rest of these boards, I think.
Before you go on, can I get just a clarification?
Good point for good time for some questions, so yes.
So you have here this hard sphere model plus the corrected version.
Yeah.
Is it purely something in vacuum? Because if you talk about spheres coming together with hydrodynamic forces in place, you don't have a curve that's a hard sphere curve. You have something where you're pushing on the particles.
Yeah, so when I'm talking about hard spheres in this kind of context, this is a static force. It doesn't have to be in vacuum. Solvent can be there, but this is not velocity dependent. So it's the force I feel to hold particles at a fixed separation.
Okay.
So that's the important distinction between these kind of forces and the hydrodynamic parts.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Just another, your little f here?
So this is the fraction of rolling contacts.
Fraction of rolling, okay.
Okay, so let me draw what we've got so far. I'm going to plot this. So this is what I was calling S of phi. It's the dimensionless number that connects the shear stress to what would be the stress of an empty solvent. And let me plot it. And I'm going to put several things on this plot. May as well use this for one of them. So that's my 64%, the jamming point at zero friction. And I'm not going to put the other one on until I've drawn some stuff. So mu of order 1 or mu greater than 1 doesn't matter. This point does move around depending on what the actual contact friction is, but it's around my 58%, something like that. And now I'm going to choose four different volume fractions, and I'm going to choose them quite carefully. So let's put one here. One there. One just inside here. So I'm just marking these points on the curves. And one over here. So the other point, the partner point of this is at infinity. Right, second big graph. So the idea now is I have a characteristic stress scale, sigma star. Let's draw this like that. And let's draw something which is maybe sigma star plus 50% and sigma star minus 50%. Doesn't matter exactly how I draw these. So let's consider case one. Let's do one in red. So I have two curves here. They are rather similar in slope. So I'll try to draw this. I told you I'd break the chalk consistently. So these are my two rate-independent curves. And the idea is that for low stresses, I'm on this one. And for high stresses, I'm on that one. So I can draw this one in pretty much up to the dotted line. And that one pretty much beyond the dotted line. So let's actually call that 2. Because one, you can imagine, this is more like here, roughly factor of 2 difference in slope. Obviously, if these are only 5% apart, then you'll see a much flatter thing there. So F equals 0, F equals 1, and there is the smooth crossover, which is that F curve translated into this arena. So what happens then, let's go to 3. The slope of the lower curve barely increases. The slope of the upper curve increases hugely. So for 3, let's draw these two again, basically something like that. and this is now piercing. So you can see what's happening. I'm still on this, and now I'm on that. And the smooth crossover has to connect them like this. There is no other way of having things. So that's three. Let's call that in this color, three. And this one is actually that color. It's two. Okay. And then in case four, again, I have a reasonable slope down here. Won't draw it. I have a divergent slope there, so I have to join up to this. And so four in green has to do something like this. And then shoot up the axis. So, sigma, gamma dot, 1, 2, 3, 4. As required. So that's the way we understand these curves now. And from it, everything follows, if you want to be rather oversimplistic about it. So let me summarize slightly and then say a bit more about the consequences of this. So if I have a smooth F of sigma telling me how many of the contacts are frictional and how many are not, but two different jamming points, I will get a fold or an S shape in the sigma gamma dot curve. So that's what you need. This is shown here graphically, and in fact this is a huge strength of the theory, because actually you don't need any clear mathematical assumptions about the exact shape of this F function or anything. So no detailed assumptions. Needed. You can think of this, as I think of it, as a rigorous graphical math. So not all mathematics requires equations. I could write that in terms of, you know, lim sub and catastrophe theory, and if within epsilon for sigma less than blah blah such that, but you can see immediately what's going on.
The inflection point of sigma star.
Around there. That's the only thing that sets the scale, because the no wiggle theorem is being broken solely by sigma star. Yeah. And this comes back to something Shriram said, is that the detailed interpretation is negotiable. And I do regard that as a strength, not a weakness. And this negotiation involves the definitions of contact and of friction. So you might think contact, okay, I'm now talking about slightly squishy particles, etc., etc. Friction has something to do with friction, but there's no microscopic theory of friction anyway. So this is negotiable, but you still get those outcome. Yeah, question.
The few nanometer distance where the force actually rises up, that isn't really important. That doesn't set anything.
No, this range doesn't set anything.
Yeah, okay. You only need it to give you a threshold force.
Yes. This is what matters here. I do also need a few nanometers, by the way, to overcome Stokes' theorem. And that's something I didn't say, but it's also true. If I look at hard sphere particles with a supposedly no slip boundary condition to water, say, typically there is a finite slip length of a few nanometers, which says that the fluid molecules at the particle surface are not actually co-moving with the solid, but they're just slightly, you know, and as soon as I do that, again, the idea of these everlasting hydrodynamic films which can never break has gone. Another way to break that is to have any kind of pointy bits on your particles which break through those films in any case. So this is where the negotiation can take place. Another comment, and I think this is important because it actually, at least I hope, reinforces the fact there's some intellectual substance in what I'm saying, and that's the following interesting thing. Because this is a type of theory which people have explored in the past, and that would be a rate dependent. Friction. And this doesn't work. So with rate-dependent friction, I say F is a function of gamma dot. Not of stress, but gamma dot. And then you can see this is subtly and yet drastically different. Because now the equivalent of those horizontal lines are vertical. So I have some characteristic rate of strain here. I can still draw this and that. But now, all I can say is that I'm on this one up to about here, and I'm on that one after about there, so the continuation of this dotted line, and this is never going to fold back. Right? So it is important what you've decided that the friction depends on. If you have, and a rate-dependent friction is close to modified theories of hydrodynamics, where you say, oh, well, actually, it's not quite Stokes' law, it's something, some other power of the velocity on approach or whatever, it won't do it for you. Because you cannot get the switch back if you draw these horizontal lines in the vertical direction. So that's one comment. So let's call it comment A. Comment B. And I didn't talk about the normal stresses since I introduced them at the beginning, but here they are. So there are these other non-zero components of the stress tensor, and they behave the same way. So they're all doing this. And I could have drawn those curves for any of the stress components. What that means is that these stresses, as well as the shear stress, have of order 10 to the 3 factor discontinuity at the transition. And this is very large. So let me just carry on with that. So if I impose my shear stress in this non-monotonic region, which I was talking about before, so in this window here, there's a theory of what should happen with this type of flow curve if you don't take into account the normal stresses. And that is, well, one thing you can do at fixed macroscopic shear stress is I can make some of this and some of that. So it's like a first-order phase coexistence. And that's in this geometry, it looks like this. X, Y, Z into the board. So I'm shearing, that's the top of my sample. Very badly drawn, that's the bottom. And the way this kind of flow instability is often resolved in this geometry would be to expect slabs here with vertical interfaces sigma 1, sigma 2, so that you split into some of this and some of that, such that the macroscopic mean, which determines the force on the top plate, which is the stress that you measure, is whatever you've imposed here. But now I have a problem, which is that the normal stress, even in the vorticity direction, that's the z direction, has a discontinuity of orders of magnitude between here. And so normal stress discontinuities basically these drive particle currents. And we think this is the reason why, even though there are some other systems where the same type of flow curve and closely related ones can arise, and you can get a steady flow through this kind of a steady state phase coexistence type structure, that in this context it seems that the huge difference in the normal stress which drives particles to and fro in the vorticity direction is enough to require essentially an unsteady flow. So, what I said earlier, the prima facie case for unsteady flow is that this instability, but we do know there's this resolution which happens in other systems, and this is, I think, why it doesn't happen here. Okay, last couple of minutes. Let me talk a bit about, very quickly, two things, and then an open and very large problem. So, C. Engineering. So you might want strategies to stop all this stuff happening. Generally, that kind of jamming I showed you there is not what you want in your paint factory or anywhere else. So strategy one, contact engineering. So now you know there are contacts and you know they're frictional, you can start thinking about what molecules can I add to my formulation, whether it's food, paint, whatever, to change that. So this is in fact widely done in foods. So you'll see this ingredient lecithin on lots and lots of food products, and in ones which are based on dense suspensions, my claim is that these are generally included as friction modifiers at the particle contacts. They're listed as emulsifiers usually on the list of ingredients. But what that does is I have my S of phi. I have the frictional one and the non-frictional one, and basically if I drop the friction enough, obviously this has got to move right over to there. So all of these wiggles and things get squashed into a narrower and narrower regime of volume fraction. The second one, let's call this flow protocol engineering. So once I've decided what the physics is of the jamming and the first order phase transition, I can think of ways to alter that. So one way, which we've been investigating numerically recently, is I'm trying to shear like this, as drawn over there, and on top of this I put an oscillatory transverse flow. So that's a wobble in the Z direction. And that's very effective. In fact, we've known for a long time that if you have particle systems and you oscillate them, the contacts tend to come apart. It's important here that the oscillation is perpendicular to the main flow. You find that you can basically get an equally big, like 7% increase in the maximum amount of solids by doing this. If you try to put the oscillation in the same direction as the forward flow, you get nothing at all. Okay, so finally, what's missing? And the answer is quite a lot. So those were some consequences over there. So I talked about the graphical math and why this is sort of powerful and kind of has a universal aspect to it, but everything I've said is based on the examination of steady-state behavior. Even showing that you can't have steady-state behavior is based on thinking about the steady-state behavior. So what's missing is any kind of theory of time-dependent flow in this type of system. So for a simple shear flow, this would be gamma dot function of t. And this is missing even in the rate-independent rheology case. In other words, even if I forget about all these wiggles and I just take a system which simply lives on one of these lines here, I still don't know how to deal with time-dependent flow. So what have we got? Stress tensor function of T. This depends on rate of strain tensor and something. This is div or grad I vj. And this is a list of structural stuff. So we have models which look roughly like this. And in these current models, the main players for the structural stuff list of, one is obviously the coordination number. And the second one, which is widely used, is something called the fabric, Q, which is Ni Nj minus 1 over D delta Ij, where this average is over contacts. And that's a unit vector between the contacts. So I can define a fabric. If I put some Fs in there, I also get part of the stress tensor. Still, a second rank tensor looks good because that's the same kind of thing as a sigma. So you might hope that you could close these equations in some description which involves some scalars and some second rank tensors. So if you have a more generally, slightly, I can look at the orientational distribution function of the contact vectors. And if I expand that in spherical harmonics, I've got 1 over 4 pi, 1, and then there's some coefficient, which is 15 over 2, q, double dot, n, so double contraction against those two indices. If I carry on with this, I get something involving a fourth rank tensor, actually 315 over 8, he says, consulting notes. Fourth rank tensor, quadruple contraction, n, and you can see why we tend not to want to go any further than that. So these current models, though, tend to involve what I would call top-down closure. At the Q level. And in other words, if I declare this equation to be closed in some scalars and Q, and I don't put any more physics in than that, unfortunately, I have 8 nonlinear functions of 9 scalar invariants. So these scalar invariants are the invariants of the rate of strain tensor and of Q. And these theories are not very good. So the reason we know they're not very good is, just my parting comment. We can compare those with simulation data on the kind of model which puts in the physics that I've talked about, so the physics of friction at contacts, whether you make the frictional force stress dependent or not. And if you look at the data, so the key thing in a rate-independent rheology is to think about reversals, and I can say more about that if people want to know at the end. But the point about this, if you have a rate-independent case, as long as you keep moving in the same direction, it doesn't matter how fast you are moving in that direction. So your whole flow into history, in fact, comprises just knowing a series of strains at which you turned round and how far you went before you turned round again. So the reversal is the key thing to think about. So if you do simulations of reversals, here's the steady flow state forward. Now what I'm plotting is P of n, just projected onto the flow and gradient plane. So roughly, this is kind of vaguely ellipsoidal. This is says that there's more contacts along the compression axis, that's what you expect. And by the time you reach the steady state in the other direction, obviously, it's roughly flipped over. But if you want to understand what's going on in these systems, you do need to understand what's happening in reversal. And the problem is that in the middle, it looks like this. It's very forelobed. That means C cannot be omitted. So then you start thinking, okay, well now I've got 395. So obviously, this is basically a blockade to top down. There is just far too many ways of constructing these models, once you know things like that are happening, to be of any value at all. So obviously, we need instead, bottom up, and in this contact, that is called statistical physics.
Sorry, ma'am, before you go,
yeah.
The follow thing is a sort of history-dependent object. It's not that if you did nothing, you have that. It's that if you start with a flowing state one way,
yes,
on the way to going flowing the other way,
mm-hmm. Mid-reversal. There's a bit of four-lobiness here, but if you look at the one you get here, it's got, you know, slightly flattened poles, and you think, well, I can get away with a Q. And there you realize you can't. Okay, so that's what's missing. Obviously, there was some statistical physics in what I described in the first part of the talk, but it's totally missing so far in the kind of models that people have been developing for proper time-dependent flows in these kind of systems. And obviously, this has been an aspect of what this program on dense suspensions has been trying to fill this gap, not specifically in this immediate context, but much more generally across the field. Thank you very much for your attention. Yes, that's the fourth harmonic, that's C.
The N and I are the different species?
So, no, N here is think of this as a function on the sphere. N is the vector from the center to the sphere. This is the probability density of finding a contact pointing in that direction. So I can expand that as spherical harmonics, and I can use, you know, cos theta and phi. Or the tensorial way of writing this is a second rank symmetric tensor, contracted twice into the vector from the center to the origin. So this is just a way of writing the spherical harmonic expansion for the contact distribution. And what I'm saying, when we truncate a Q, we're used to thinking of this as involving only the dipolar part, but we need to think about the quadrupolar part. Because that has a second rank tensor in here, there's a proliferation of variables that is completely out of control in the context of trying to guess the form of the equations from the top down. That's what I was saying there.
Oh, there's a lot of symmetry. Yes.
Well, surprisingly little when you're, say, in the middle of a reversal of flow, because you it has some symmetry, which is mainly that it doesn't have structure that distinguishes positive and negative z. But everything else is possible.
Go either way, see. But has five.
Well, it may have a relatively small number of numbers to define C, but they all depend on Q, or rather they depend on the rate of strain and the coordination of etc. So it's those functions. So I didn't even try to write down what we have at this level, and it's bad enough.
So Mike, I'm going to ask you a question I asked Wilson. You didn't give me a satisfactory answer, so I'm going to get a chance. So my understanding is, you know, there's presentation of a theory that's hopefully explaining that's phenomenologically motivated.
Yeah.
It seems like there were some predicted things. For example, the sigma star prediction going like 1/r².
Yeah.
Is that experimentally verified?
Well, obviously there were simplifications in the theory.
Understood.
There is certainly some evidence that those things are stacking up roughly right. I wouldn't say verified at this point, but I've not seen anything which makes me think, oh my goodness,
this
is all wrong.
Is there any way to test the increased prevalence of rolling behavior, just by if there's a way to measure the rotation of the...
Well, it's easy enough in a simulation, of course.
No, I understand. Fine.
Yeah, but I mean, in fact, with confocal microscopy, you should be able to do it, but it's a big task, and someone like Wilson would probably have to spend a year working on that. I mean, to get orientational motion in colloidal suspensions by microscopy is... I think a few people can do it.
Yeah, so what do you mean by statistical physics being bottom up?
Well, what we have here is, what do I mean by it being bottom up? Oh, well, so statistical physics, in this context, we have particles. Our fundamental particles are the quasi-hard spheres. They are interacting via forces. They have some very complicated relation between their geometry and the force structure. So we need a theory of this, basically. Well, I don't think that that's the right tool. It's more like a partition function, but the dynamic equivalent of. I'm not sure there's nice fixed points and scalings of that kind. There might be some. I think, yeah, and that's a good question. But statistical mechanics in the sense of you know the microscopic interaction Hamiltonian in a spin system or whatever, and from that you calculate the heat capacity as a function of temperature. You might be interested in critical points. Because this was a first order transition, we're not so interested in critical point as in the RG sense, but understanding the first order transition from a stat mech point of view is an equal challenge, I would say.
For example, some bottom up reason to factorize C as a product of Qs.
That doesn't work.
So it doesn't work?
Well, I mean, so there are certainly strategies for expressive, but factorizing C as a product of Qs is closure at Q level. And when you do that, you cannot get four-lobe structures that are not collinear with the Q tensor. So I didn't show details, but if I project this onto Q, the Q axis is somewhere like that. And if I close at Q level, I can get four lobes, but only by having them oriented in that sense. So, so that doesn't, unfortunately, solve it for us. Sorry? No, because two Qs add up to a third Q. Those two ellipsoids in spherical harmonics, I can't get four lobes by adding two Qs. I've got to square them before I add them or something. Yeah.
So, Mike, you said statistical physics, but
yes.
Most of the experiments were on particles that are big enough that the microscopic dynamics isn't.
Indeed. So this is not thermal physics.
It's caused the big shear.
Yeah. Right. So it's not thermal physics, but it is the statistical behavior of large numbers of particles. Okay. And you have to relate that directly to the dynamical history of the system rather than some convenient appeal to Boltzmann equilibrium or similar. So that's indeed why it's a tough call.
So can you really say that you can ignore thermal fluctuations, or is it just you can quantify? Can you quantify how much there?
So the thermal fluctuations, for instance, are a good substitute for this short-range soft repulsion. In fact, they have an extremely... So if I put a little bit of Brownian motion but keep the particles hard, then they tend to stay apart in a way which is extremely similar to having interparticle force. So it's just harder to do that case than via F. Because the, quote, standard model, you know, everything is taken to the limit, you can break it in any direction you want. And Brownian motion is certainly one of them.
But if you were to break it, wouldn't that just give you a rate-dependent hit that's not the reaction? It would be a relaxation time.
Well, at least you get some wiggle. But if you wanted to go S-shaped, then at the moment I don't see how to do that other than by bringing in friction or something like friction, which changes the constraint counting. Bob?
So there are interesting analogs in dry granular systems, as you know. And one of them is if you do cyclic shear on a dry granular system, you have the same issue that if you're building up structures that you can't necessarily predict terribly well. But it might be an interesting test bed where you can actually probe because you can look at these things.
Yes.
And see in gory detail what's
going on. So one of the things which has emerged from this picture over the last 5 years is that this far more in common between these systems and the dry granular ones than we ever imagined, because once you start talking about a friction-dominated contact packing, then they're basically the same problem with different sets of constraints on them. So yes, so that's another way of looking directly and measuring things like this in an experiment, and I agree that would be a very interesting thing to do.
Scott, is there a second-order point in your parameter space?
Is there no second-order point? Yeah, no, there's a point where this fold first happens. Yeah, so somewhere here, there's a point with a vertical inflection.
So is that an interesting point to study?
That's a very good idea. It's extremely difficult to locate. So if you start marching, the problem is that you can't, the concentration is something that you make at the beginning. You mix your sample. And if you want to find that point, you're going to have to subdivide the concentration range into sort of micro percentages, because it very, very quickly goes into this, you know, huge first-order jump. But having said that, there should be ways to do that, and I don't think anyone has looked at it. Again, numerically, it'd be easy. And that's something we should do. That's
a good point. But instead of doing an RG analysis, that would be the point.
That would be the point.
You could ask where you find it.
Yeah, that would, I agree. The thing is, one is so distracted by suddenly having a 10 to the 3 jump, that the kind of the details of the many-body character of that bifurcation, that's what we're talking about. Obviously, this whole thing is like mean field theory. There's a kind of classical Landau-like bifurcation point there, and I agree that there should be an RG, or at least some, you know, non-trivial scaling stuff going on at that point. Whether the experimentalists would be pleased to learn that that's what we're all suddenly interested in, I'm not sure.